This is the order of battle!
Thanks for joining the Order of Battle podcast for another episode. Joel, Jason, and Sometimes A discuss collecting G.I. Joe, other 1/18 scale action figures, and in general, what sparks joy. It's a lot of things, but almost always toys. This is the Order of Battle podcast. I had the immense pleasure of sitting down with Andrew Lee Griffith and John Barber. If the names sound familiar, they should. Andrew was an artist on A Real American Hero with Larry Hama for several issues. John Barber was an IDW editor over the Hasbro properties. Together, they have both written or drawn for G.I. Joe, Transformers, Star Wars, and more. Andrew has also been on the Talking Joes podcast more than once. These two are great. They're a lot of fun. They have worked on a number of the properties that we all love. And now they're kickstarting their own personal project, which ties in the themes and visuals from all of these properties that they grew up with alongside of all of us, have had a hand in making at a professional level, and still collect with all of us. I hope you enjoy this conversation as it meanders through everything that I know you and I both love. And I hope you check out Cigna, S-I-G-N-A, on Kickstarter. It looks amazing, and personally, I cannot wait to read it. So you guys have both worked on G.I. Joe. You've worked together on Transformers. You've both worked on Star Wars. So I have your shit in my house. I'm kind of an odd bird with Transformers because I grew up with G1. But Rescue Bots and Animated have supplanted G1 as my favorite Transformers. I still like G1. Don't get me wrong. But you guys have worked on a whole lot of Transformers. Like with G.I. Joe, I saw when I was just kind of looking at your list, there's Road to Revolution stuff, there's Mask, Micronauts, ROM, all of the IDW tie-in with G.I. Joe. How have you guys navigated moving through all these different things for as long as you have to get to a point where now you're like, I want to make my own thing outside of these publishers and put it on Kickstarter?
Who wants to go first, John?
You can if you want.
Well, I think part of it, like, you know, we both grew up loving all this stuff. I mean, we both grew up reading comics, being into Transformers and Star Wars and all that kind of stuff. Some of my first comics ever were literally Transformers, some of the first issues of Transformers. And then I got into like Secret Wars and Spider-Man and all that kind of stuff, but also G.I. Joe. And it was this weird time period where like I was getting into stuff and my brother was a few years older than me. So he was already kind of collecting that stuff. So I kind of don't remember some of like what I was first reading and first buying, but I believe the first comic I ever bought was Secret Wars number 8. That was like Spider-Man with when he first got the black costume.
Yeah. Familiar.
And then I got really into like the storyline with, the symbiote costume saga and all that stuff, the alien costume saga. And at the same time, you know, Spider-Man was showing up in Transformers and everything was just crossing over, and I was really loving it. And I'd already been into Star Wars, but mostly just like the toys and the movies and stuff. I wasn't so much in the comics and things, but I got really into comics for like a long time, for most of my childhood into my teen years. And I was like really into comics. I always wanted to work on them. I always wanted to tell stories. I always wanted to like dive into those worlds. So, but my thing was like mostly art, you know, that's what I was good at. That's what I took to. When I finally like got a chance to get my pathway into comics, kind of happened because I got married. I kind of settled down at home. It was at home more. I started drawing again, started posting things online. And then Chris Ryle at IDW actually reached out to me and asked me if I ever did. He was the editor in chief at the time. And he said, do you ever do like movie Transformers? And I hadn't at the time, but I quickly did some sketches and things and sent them off. And not too much longer after that, they brought me in to help ink a series. And then I did some fill-in art. And then that led to one thing to another thing. And then once I got like working on the movie comics for Transformers, John got involved and he wrote the one series that they put me on as the artist. And we just got along, you know, really well. And we worked together really well. And everybody, all the fans seemed to like it and everything. We just had a good relationship working wise. And then they launched an ongoing series for G1 Transformers, like the modern version. And John and I were brought onto that because they liked how we worked together. And then, but we both had been talking amongst ourselves about how we'd always wanted to tell our own stories as well. You know, like we just really wanted to get into more creator-owned stuff. That's something that we had both wanted to do for even before we worked in this modern Transformer stuff. We have emails going back to like 2011 when we were talking about, hey, let's do a creator-owned thing. You know, I have ideas. You have ideas. Let's talk. And that's kind of what eventually led into this. And I don't know if John wants to add to it or.
The funny thing, and I hadn't really thought about this until you asked this question. When I first kind of like got into Transformers, and I've told this part of the story before, but like I had a friend named Steve Petrazek, and I mentioned him because he's back Cigna. He just messaged me on Facebook. This is back when I was in kindergarten. We actually lost touch for a long time and then managed to reconnect because I mentioned him in an interview like that. But he had the Diachron toys, which were the like Takara, before they made a deal with Hasbro, they released some of the stuff in toy shops in the 80s, just as Diachron in the US. In those days, you wouldn't have to go to like some weird specialty import shop. It was just like a regular, like maybe KB toy store or something would have some like weird imports or, you know, weird toys that you didn't see at major ones. But I remember seeing those and just being like, whoa, you know, like that's amazing. And I started buying some of them, you know, whenever I could. And I didn't know what the story was. So I had to make up like my own total story for what these things were. They were the Transformers toys, but they had little guys with them, you know, so I had all this stuff. So I guess in a weird way, there's this part of me that like the first thing I ever did with this stuff was like make up my own stories and want to do that. And that was really like not that particularly, but like going in and telling my own stories is one of the reasons I wanted to get into comics. You know, like that was like the, you know, especially growing up in the 80s, 90s, you didn't have a device in your pocket that could shoot a TV show. You know what I mean? Like that stuff was way out of the reach. But comics are something you could do. You know, you'd sit there with a piece of paper and draw a comic. And I was like really inspired by like Kevin Eastman and Peter Laird with the Turtles and stuff, where they just did their own thing. And I'm like, man, that's what I want to do. I want to do my own thing and then get, you know, I'm sure I'll be as successful as Kevin, Peter. But so, you know, for me, it was always like that was always the thing I wanted to do. And I followed like artists and writers pretty early on. Like I had that period where I was just, you know, reading all. I got into comics via G.I. Joe. Like that was my big one. Pretty quickly was like, oh, I like, I like these artists. I like this writer. I'm going to follow them wherever they go. And it wasn't really till I started getting like a job in comics that I like really went back to like, OK, well, now I've got to know all about like Spider-Man and stuff, or I'll read all of Avengers just to see what that's like, because I would have only read Avengers if I liked the person making it, you know. Post IDW for me, it's been kind of rediscovering that and being like, oh, yeah, I can like whatever I want. I can read whatever comics I want, and we can also make what we want to do. And I mean, Andrew and I had been talking about this, like you said, from like day one. So it was a long time coming, but just kind of finally getting able to do our own thing. And it's not to say that we were like not able to tell the stories we wanted to tell in Transformers. I would say far from it. You know, I think we really were able to do all kinds of stuff there. But that idea of just kind of making your own thing, not just, you know, not just doing like Star Wars again, but doing the same thing that like George Lucas was, which he's inspired by Dune and Kurosawa and Flash Gordon and, you know, all these zillion things, you know, he was inspired by, but he crafted something new and it was interesting and, you know, inspired us. So not that this is going to be, you know, this is the next Star Wars. I'll call it.
We're all kind of the same age. And when I was coming up, I restarted with G.I. Joe, but I don't know what I had before then, but I know I was reading a ton of stuff, you know, Battle Beasts and X-Men and Avengers and everything. But as much as I loved drawing as a kid and all through high school and not really since then, I never followed a specific artist. I always followed a character. And as much as I loved the writing, I never followed authors. I followed the characters. So to hear that, you know, at a very young age, that progression, I think is really kind of mind-blowing. I don't know. It's very cool. Because I wish I had a little bit more of that as a kid, because I'm following a character, and depending on who the writer, that character is up or down. Whereas if you're following your favorite authors or favorite artists, favorite colorists, you're always at the peak of what they're doing, and you're learning from these people instead of trying to decode it from a mix-mash of people via Scott Summers.
I mean, you have both. You know what I mean? Like, there definitely was, like, I got exposed to Walter Simonson because I was reading X-Men comics, and he was drawing, Louise was writing, he was drawing X-Factor, you know, like that. I wouldn't have run into him probably just on my own, you know? Yeah. I mean, it was sort of weird. Like, Turtles was a big one for me because, like, that story of those guys was so inspiring. You know what I mean? Like, I like the comic, but I was kind of, by the time Turtles hit, you know, the big, broad, widescreen stuff, I was in middle school. So it wasn't like I was like reading that as a, like my son's 5 years old. He's super into Ninja Turtles. He doesn't know that Kevin Eastman lives nearby. He doesn't care, right? Like, that's not the thing. It's that Raphael's cool and I want to be the blue guy with the swords. You know, what's his name again? You need all of it. But yeah, there was some stuff that really, yeah, pushed me certain directions, I guess. I remember talking to Brian Bendis said something like a long time ago that was like, he kind of followed, you know, path sort of similar to what I'm saying, I think, but realizing that for other people, that isn't how they interacted with comics. And it was more like sports, you know, like you don't stop liking your sports team when a player changes or something. If you're a fan of, you know, your local sports, if you're a fan of the Angels, you know, I mean, I grew up, you know, in Anaheim, it doesn't matter. The players change. Sometimes you're being a fan of them is just getting mad at them because they're not very good and that you're still a fan.
Yeah, looking back, I guess I tended to follow the book more. Like, sometimes I'd follow the artist or the writer to a new thing, but like, I was really into Spider-Man. And then I had a subscription. They had all kinds of different artists doing it that had almost like a house style, like that late 80s kind of house style. And then all of a sudden, like Todd McFarlane jumped on the scene. It just kind of blew my mind. And I was, you know, really into that. And then like, Eric Larson came in after that and everything, and then Mark Bagley, I guess. But like, you know, I would just kind of read the book regardless of who the artist was. And some I like more than others. But then the same thing with like X-Men. I had a huge run of X-Men that I collected. And then, you know, Mark Silvestri came in and I loved his stuff. And then Jim Lee, and I didn't know, you know, the superstar he'd become, but I was like, oh, this is cool. I like this a lot, you know? I don't know. I can't think of any situations where like I followed books just because of the creators. I was usually kind of more into like the continuity and the characters personally.
I've always been way into the narrative. And so to switch based on the creative team, I've tried it a few times. It always feels a bit chaotic for me because I'm trying to backtrack on the narrative and figure out what I missed. And now I'm reading a wiki page and that's no fun.
Yeah, trying to go back and catch up with what had come before is mind-boggling sometimes.
You guys have been doing this for a while together then, but when you guys both touched, because I mean, most of what we talk about are toys and G.I. Joes. When you guys worked on the G.I. Joe stuff, you guys were working on that at a pretty interesting time. Larry's Larry. He's doing his thing. And then IDW has a handful of stuff coming out where they're trying to do alternate stuff, including like a Hasbro combined universe. And I mean, you guys have been in the industry long enough where you've seen your favorite titles, whether it's X-Men or G.I. Joe or Transformers, peak, eat shit, the whole nine. And both of you growing up on G.I. Joe and Transformers, Star Wars, I mean, we're of a people. How does that translate for you guys when you're in the mix and you're having to deal with, you know, fan one comes up and is like, I love what you're doing. The next fan comes up and it's like, who do you think you are? And then, you know, you're having to navigate that month to month, right?
Well, I'd actually be more in terms of that conversation. I'd also be interested in hearing more from John because he was like editing all that stuff at the time that they had the combined Hasbro universe and what his experience was like. I'm curious about that too. We haven't talked that much about that.
There are a number of times where I've come onto things, and I don't think I've caused this, but like I've come into things where they had peaked in some sort of commercial or artistic level, and then we're for whatever reason not there anymore. Like, I've worked on like the Ultimate titles at Marvel.
I loved the Ultimate Universe, by the way. It moved me out of 616, and when they killed 1610, I walked away from superheroes.
I really love that universe too, but you know, I mean, I got to work on like Ultimates 2 and Bagley on Ultimate Spider-Man and some like the but then Ultimate X-Men got in like this weird pattern where they were waiting for Bryan Singer's writers to come on, so everybody had this sort of Damocles hanging over them. That, you know, like Brian Vaughn was supposed to come on for like 6 issues, and then I was like, hey, do you want to do another 6? How about another 12? And then finally he finishes this big story. It's like, well, do you want to do another year? He goes, no, I finished the story. But like with G.I. Joe, I think when IDW got G.I. Joe, and I wasn't there, so I'm not like positive about stuff, but my understanding has always been that like G.I. Joe was the big one. Like G.I. Joe was a bigger franchise than Transformers. And you'd see that they put out more G.I. Joe comics. You know, they had Larry one, but then they had, you know, Cobra and G.I. Joe and, you know, I mean, they had G.I. Joe Origins when it launched. And somewhere like a shift had happened before I came on where the Transformers stuff had kind of started getting to be bigger. I mean, a big shift, I think, was that the Transformers movie came out and the Michael Bay one. And unlike most other movies like that, whatever you might say about that movie, it did make fans. Like it did get people to be fans of Transformers and seek out other Transformers stuff, where like the G.I. Joe movie absolutely did not.
That is true.
Yeah. And not even speaking of the relative qualities or anything, it just didn't work that way. So you had this like sort of weird crossover where Transformers was ascending and G.I. Joe's popularity was sort of descending. So I kept having to be tasked with, both by Hasbro IDW and just creatively, like trying to figure out, well, what can we do to, you know, bump this up back up? What can we do with G.I. Joe? And Hasbro, I think, also had trouble internally with G.I. Joe. Not trouble, but I just mean like selling it. Like this, like within a few years, you couldn't find G.I. Joe toys very much. When G.I. Joe 2, the movie, came out, like, I don't know if you remembered it or if you've talked about this on a podcast or whatever, but they'd shipped product to stores, and then they moved the movie 9 months to upscale it to 3D because Avengers had steamrolled Battleship. And the decision was like, okay, well, if we can't, oh, it must have been because Avengers was in 3D, not that Avengers was a much better movie. That killed G.I. Joe at retail for a long time. Like it's exciting now to be able to go into like a Target and they have a whole G.I. Joe section now. And I know it's aimed at older collectors more than younger kids, but it's still exciting to see that, because from that moment, there wasn't stuff in stores. I mean, I think for a while, IDW making G.I. Joe comics was the only G.I. Joe thing that was out there. And then somebody did a Storm Shadow sneakers. So a pair of sneakers, and that was like the next product, you know. Like it was like I have this like continuing guilt that I am responsible for more unsuccessful relaunches of G.I. Joe than anyone else, because I love G.I. Joe. Like G.I. Joe is the comic that made me get into comics. It was also the comic that taught me about like the form of comics, where like issue 21, the silent issue, was so formative to me and other people like my age that grew up with comics, that whoa, you can do that with comics. You can do a whole comic where you're storytelling with just the pictures. Like it's a whole different medium, you know, kind of understanding that. And some of the Larry would sometimes use Steranko type tricks with the way he would write stuff, or sometimes he did layouts on the 21, but you know, so there's things like that. I mean, it was hugely important to me. So I feel like I, you know, let G.I. Joe down a few times.
Well, can I tell you a nice story?
Yeah.
You know who Drew Moss is, obviously. Mm-hmm. You've hired him. Drew and I became friends at Heroes Con, and then we find out we have mutual friends. So a year or so after that, we're at Heroes Con. I'm walking over to say, you know, good morning. We're all doing setup. He's got his booth set up, and he starts jumping up and down and freaking out. He's like, Jay, I got pulled in to do some last minute art on Mask. Congratulations, my guy. That's amazing. He was like, it's even more amazing than that. I got to draw Zartan. And he pulls the issues out, flips through them, shows it to me. It was like, you have to take these with you. I don't know who else I can tell that will understand my level of excitement. I got to draw Zartan in a Mask comic book. And he's shoving these in my hand. And I'm like, dude, these are already in my pull box. I don't care. Take them. You have to have these. I think Drew is a sweetheart. But, you know, when you talk about like your time and you're worried about this and that, I enjoyed that stuff. I also follow an 80-20 rule of any property, 80% is for me. The 20% that's not for me is the open door for you. So when I would read something, I haven't liked every single one of Larry's comics. I mean, and Larry is, you know, a god amongst men for us.
Definitely.
So with what you were doing at IEW, yeah, there was some stuff I absolutely loved. Some stuff maybe not, but I still remember the joy of watching Drew bounce. And he's not huge, but he's not tiny. He's 6 foot. And him just bouncing in spot, excited to tell me how he got to draw Zartan in a comic.
Yeah.
And now he's drawing Thundercats.
Yeah, I've had those moments myself for sure. You know, like, oh my God, I can't believe I'm getting to draw, you know, Cobra Commander preening behind, you know, a bunch of monitors, even talking to Dr. Mindbender. Like, just getting to draw these characters being so like them, you know, I don't know. It just, working with Larry was just, I definitely have those kind of moments where I can relate to what he was experiencing. Yeah.
Well, you both have lived the dream that every single one of us have had. There's not a one of us that were on the playground that didn't have the dream of making these stories. We might not have understood what an editor-in-chief was, or a penciler versus an inker versus a colorist, but we all had the dream of making these stories, and you guys have gotten to live that.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I still have, like, recently I went through my old childhood drawings, and I found a whole bunch of old, like, comics that I had drawn and stuff, and, like, wow, ever since I was 5 or 6, I've been trying to do this, you know, and just, I often have that thing where I'll stop and think about, wow, you know, I got to do like maybe I did like maybe 7 issues of the Real American Hero book, but like just to think that like, you know, I got to work on and draw on this series that was one of the first series that I got into as a kid. And it's the same continuity. It's still going on. And if that kid that was me then knew that, you know what I mean? It would have just blown my mind that 40 years later, I'd be getting to contribute to what I was enjoying. And it just, yeah, it's really something to stop and think about.
Your separation from Kevin Bacon is at a zero because you are part of the same line as issue 21.
That's right.
Even the other, last year, I guess we did a 40th anniversary, kind of like a cover remake issue of that. And I got to do a page for that. I kind of got to do 2 pages sort of, but that's another story. But
I mean, you could tell it. That's what I'm here for. I have it. It's on my bookshelf. I love it.
It started out because they sent out like this blast email to all the artists who had been currently working on G.I. Joe or who had recently worked on it. Like maybe even people who had worked on it years ago. But they're all like, hey, we're doing this book. We've got like, 22 pages. Pick a page and let us know which page you'd like to recreate. And then we'll sort it out, you know, after that, figure out who gets what. And I just wrote back like right away with which page I wanted. They're like, great. You can have that page. I'm like, awesome. So I started working on it. I did the pencils, sent them in, and they're like, oh man, shit. We double booked this page. So like the other artist is already inking his. So we're going to so here's what we'll do. You'll be the only artist that's in the book twice. So we'll give you another page. You can do that page. And then the page you did, we'll put the pencils in the back. So like you get like a bonus page in the back, but yeah, it was just a matter of like double booking. And I still got to take part in it. And like, I remember thinking I was working on that G.I. Joe book in 2022. And I was like, wow, it's almost 40 years old, this franchise. And I was like, I'd love to do something for the 40th anniversary. And I ended up being able to. So once again, it worked out for me, you know?
That's amazing.
One of my best friends from when I was later on in third grade was Patrick Von Fritzko.
Let's get through all your friends, John.
Yeah, let's do it. He was super into. He and I were like the two kids in like third grade that were like into comics, and we like stayed into comics. But he was also super into G.I. Joe. He was the kid who had the USS flag under his bed, right?
Oh man!
And he's still a big G.I. Joe fan, huge fan. You know, I still talk to him. I was at his wedding. I don't know, like a year and a half ago, he got married. And like afterwards, everybody, you know, goes to a bar after the reception. And he just sits down and he's like, he wants to just talk G.I. Joe. He's like, he has nearly all of the Real American Hero run. And he's been intentionally like not going out and buying like the last ones on eBay or something. He wants to go to conventions and find them, you know. Yeah, you know, so you just sit there at his wedding talking about G.I. Joe comics.
It's a weird obsession, but we love it.
Yeah, well, no, but it keeps you, reminds you why you like it. Yeah, exactly, exactly, exactly. And that keeps you like, no, this is cool. This is great. Like, this can't be better.
G.I. Joe was one of those things that even when I stopped collecting toys as a teenager, I kept collecting the comic. And Transformers was one of those things that was always second or third to G.I. Joe. that and the whole 80-20 thing and everything else has allowed me to really enjoy the fact that Transformers, for whatever reason in its fandom, has been allowed to reinvent itself every couple of years in very strange ways. You know, I remember there was a floating shark chasing the Autobots in one of the cartoons. You can do whatever in Transformers.
Is that Skynet you're talking about?
I think so, yeah.
We were able to bring him back for Robots in Disguise. It was kind of fun.
I would love a Michael Bay level of G.I. Joe movie. I didn't like any of the Michael Bays, not even the first one. But you can't argue with the results of Transformers is deeply entrenched in the zeitgeist and the minds of children and adolescents and everyone. Whereas G.I. Joe has definitely fallen off, even though, you know, with the lore of G.I. Joe saving Marvel and the lore of G.I. Joe doing this and outselling Spider-Man and outselling, I would love it. Which I know we're down a very deep rabbit hole when we're here to talk about Cigna, but you know, you guys have this history that you bring into Cigna, and it is what it is. How often do I get to tell you guys, I've enjoyed your artwork, I've enjoyed your writing or your editing? And that's really how I like to use my platform, is for me to just be happy about shit.
Yeah, it's funny too, because like when we were talking about maybe doing this podcast here with you, I was thinking, well, you know, I did a lot of G.I. Joe stuff, and I'm like, well, John can come on too because he edited it. But I had forgotten that John also wrote a lot of G.I. Joe stuff for the Optimus Prime series because they had a pretty big role in that book.
Yeah, Kay was a big G.I. Joe fan. So like, we put a lot of G.I. Joe in Kay Zama, who was drawing it.
That's kind of the cool thing about creatives at our age group, is you've been here, you've made your bones, you've proven yourselves, and now you guys get to, when you get to touch something that you've loved since childhood, you have a feel for it, and you get to put a little bit of yourself into it, play in that space. And I think that's really neat. I'm jealous as hell. You guys have succeeded in what we all want to do. And I'm always fascinated by those of you guys who didn't follow the get a job with insurance, safe, you know, 401k sort of plans, and instead followed the creative dreams that we all have. And somewhere along each of our paths, it kind of dies off.
I appreciate that. I mean, that's something I always kind of wanted myself, is to not have like the 9-to-5 showing up at an office I'm miserable in kind of job. I've had those jobs. And that's always what I've wanted to avoid. You know, like when I was younger, I thought I'd be more like bohemian, trying to sell art in galleries and things like that, you know, like lofty artsy kind of ideas. And I kind of grew out of that too, and back into this kind of stuff. But ultimately, I just love telling stories. So, and a lot of the stories that I grew up with loving, you know, that's what I've been able to do with these different franchises. And like John said, we've been really lucky that Hasbro, and even like the Star Wars stuff that I got to do, like they've been really good about letting us tell the stories we want to and not interfering too much, you know, except for like continuity issues and things like that. But we've been very, very fortunate in our careers. I mean, speaking for myself, at least, I mean, I feel like I've been very fortunate in what I've been able to do, and that I've been able to do it regularly for this long, you know? Yeah, I don't know. I mean, John, I'm assuming you'd agree.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. No, I don't know if I have anything to add.
But that's one thing, too, about like the whole Cigna thing, is how it came about us just wanting to tell stories. And we had things we wanted to get out, things we wanted to say. And if people want to read it and can enjoy it and get the things out of it that we got out of the stuff we grew up reading, even better, you know?
I will say, like, one of the nice things about 2024, and, you know, it's a fraught time, right? But one of the things is, like, it's more possible to, at any point in your life, still do that. You know what I mean? Like there are definitely times during COVID, you know, things got rough for a lot of people, I think. You know, certainly worse than I had it, but it was still a rough time. And there were definitely times where I was like, I'm done. I just want to get out. I just want to get that job now. I just want to get that 9-to-5 job and just go home and not think about the stuff. And then I'd be able to just do whatever I want on the side. And then at some point I'm like, wait a minute, I actually could just do that. And that, you know, that really, you know, like Cigna is exactly that. But like, it's easy for me to say that because I'm not drawing giant robots on every single page. I can just write, and then 100 robots walk through the door and, then go take a nap.
It's always the writer who says that comics is the medium with no, with an unlimited budget, right? It's always the writers who say that. It's never the artist.
Yeah. Yeah. No, Tells all the time. The time where it was like one of the Dark Cybertron issues where Alex Milne emails me. And it's like the last page is like, and then 5 billion robots come from the sky. And he's like, five billion robots. And I'm like, listen, Alex, you could just draw a billion. Nobody's going to know.
There's a funny story about that. We were doing Dark Cybertron, and a few of us artists were sharing the art responsibilities. So like, Alex did some issues, I did some issues. And then Alex drew that scene, like the last splash page of the one issue. I drew the first couple pages of the next issue. And I'd been waiting for a script. You know, I'm sitting around like, I need something to do. I want to get some money coming in, waiting. So I was emailing them like, hey, do you guys have a script ready? And it felt like I was bugging them. So I get this email back with a script. And it's like, yeah, here's something you can work on. And it said, 1 billion Ammonites drop down from the sky. And I'm like, wait, are they screwing with me? Like, is this just like, okay, here you go. So I'm like, I wrote them back. I'm like, you didn't mistype, right? It says a billion. You want me to draw 1 billion little guys? But it turned out it really was 1 billion in the script. So well, that's so much. That's a little bit easier for the writer, just a little bit.
Yeah. I will say I've gotten not in trouble, but like, I think I confuse, like every once in a while, like I will, oh, not every once in a while, you've seen my scripts forever. I'll write stuff that I'm trying to get across, like the emotion of the scene or something, you know? So it's like, I was describing a monster to somebody and I'm like, you know, dimensions, you know, like all the Lovecraftian stuff, dimensions rolling into themselves and all the stuff. And I'm just like, kind of trying to get the feel for, this is like a crazy monster. The artist is like, what do you want? I'm like, well, I don't know. Give him a big mouth. I mean, I've loved everything else you've done. I'm not like throwing you a loop here. Just draw a big guy in front and then some little dots in the back. I'm fine. No, I'm just kidding. It's obviously it's harder.
I always feel like the best summation of all this is John's story about was it the Authority?
Yeah.
Were you okay telling that, or is that?
When I worked on Ultimates, I was working with Brian Hitch, and he was telling me this story that I've like just like stolen and made my own, you know, story. But it was on the comic The Authority that was Warren Ellis and Brian Hitch. And there's a sequence in there.
And that was a great book.
Oh, yeah, it was. Yeah, absolutely. And there's a sequence where a alternate universe English empire with spaceships has entered our reality. Hundreds of alien or of these alternate universe ships are coming. Then the U.S. Air Force takes off and they're coming in to try to intercept them. And there's a 2-page spread where the script was the fleets engage. And it was a week of Brian Hitch's life. So yeah, I told Andrew that. That's always been the fleets engage.
John and I would always do a lot of double page spreads and robots in disguise, you know, in our book. It was almost like a regular thing. And some of those would take me about like a week of my life to get done. Like the ones that were huge battles with tons of Transformers, and Transformers take so much longer than anything else to draw. And a lot of like reference. Livio Ramondelli and I talk about this a lot. Like you always have to look up a lot of reference because each Transformer has its own like anatomy, you know, except unless they're like a repaint or something, but it just takes so much time. We always have so many windows open of so many different like angles and different the way different people drew them and stuff. It's just, yeah, because especially with the fandom, you don't want to get them wrong, you know?
Yeah, and I could just go through and I could be like, you know, this guy, you know, Wheeljack smiles. And then somebody's like, Wheeljack doesn't have a mouth. Okay,
yeah.
Doesn't smile.
Yeah, I'm impressed by anybody who can draw Transformers. That is insane amount of detail. And it's gotten worse over the years. Original Transformers were at least blocky. Now it's... If you can't draw a full engine block from eyes closed, like, can you even draw a Transformer anymore? It's an insane amount of detail.
I had people ask me, like, do you have, like, an engineering degree or something? I'm like, no. Just somehow make it work. I don't know.
But you've taken that skill set and the fact that you know how long it takes to draw Transformers, and then you said, let's do mechs for your own property.
Well, it's funny, like, as I remember how this came about, like, my recollection of it was, when I was working on Transformers, I had wanted to do more writing and stuff, so I pitched a Transformer story, actually, about, like, a big, powerful Transformer, Six-Shot, and this kind of bounty hunter character, and John, at the time, was editing. He's like, well, I know this isn't going to fit in, you know, with what we have planned out. We don't really have room for it. He's like, but I really like, the feel of it and, like, the vibe of it. He's like, hey, maybe we can, like, you know, create our own universe and like tell our own story along these kind of lines. That kind of led into us talking about what became Cigna. So, and some of the elements of that pitch are kind of still in here. So that's kind of why it has a mech in it, because we started out in the first place with a robot. And then it helps too, because like people know us for that stuff. So when they see John and me working on a creator-owned thing, I think they're like, oh, it's got big robots in it. They're like, we're going to come along for that. You know what I mean? So it just kind of worked out. It wasn't so much that we were like, hey, let's do what people are going to want to see us do. It just kind of came together that way.
And then you convinced Rhonda, Chris, and Mason to join you guys on the team.
Yeah. I don't even know the story of how Mason got involved. One day he was just there. We're like, hey, we're doing our weekly call and Mason's jumping in. And I love him. I've been I consider him a friend now and stuff. We've been working on this together for so long. But
when he came over, when I came over to Pug W, he was already here part time, and he was working on some of the comic stuff. This is Mason's story. This is another story I'm stealing. Mason was the guy at Golden Apple Comics who gave Samuel L. Jackson the copy of Ultimates that made Samuel L. Jackson realize he was Nick Fury, and that led to him walking out holding that comic, calling his agent, and led to him being in the movies.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I didn't know Mason before then, but I always like having an editor, and I like having an editor that's going to like call me on stuff, you know, and like, I was in a weird situation that I got at IDW. I'd left Marvel. I was an editor at Marvel. I left Marvel, got hired to write the Transformer stuff with Andrew that we were talking about. And we both got the ongoing series. And then I got hired as an editor to replace Andy Schmidt as the like lead editor on the Hasbro stuff. So it was like a weird, it was always been like an awkward situation. Cause like, I don't want to just have like nobody overseeing stuff, you know, like somebody needs to be able to say this doesn't work or whatever. So when you had Carlos Guzman and then David Marriott, you know, and David Hedgecock, other people have edited some of the stuff. I really appreciated it. And I always had this like a little Carlos on my shoulder, where whenever I'd write something and then I'd like imagine myself trying to explain why I'd written it that way to Carlos, I would realize I'm writing it wrong. I'm making excuses. So I'd go back and rewrite stuff. So Mason, just kind of seeing him work on some of the stuff that we'd worked on together, I knew he like knew comics and he understood the stuff. And he also understood the story we were kind of trying to tell. It made sense that he was the other person I was working with on the comic stuff at Pug W. I mean, a lot of the other stuff we do is like games or art books or animation stuff, you know, like it's a lot of different things that we do. So we got lucky that he was there, but we got real lucky because he's really good. And I think he was the hero on issue 2 of making that come together story-wise. You know, obviously Andrew's the hero of making it come together visually, but it's already paid off for us, I think.
Chris, the letterer, like he'd been a long time IDW letterer. He'd written things there, and he was actually kind of instrumental in me kind of getting this work too, because he had pointed out a few things that I had done online to some people. He was working, you know, at IDW, and he'd pass along some stuff he saw me do. I took part in a contest and he judged it and stuff. And like something about my username or something, he got what it was a reference to. We got talking through private messages. We've been like great friends for like 15, 16 years now. And we'll still like message each other stuff about how Shipwreck was in this like Cobra bar in the middle of a desert. And he's dressed as like the sailor man. And like G.I. Joe just takes him back to the base and like, he's just slapping CoverGirl's ass. There's no like background check. He's just giving orders. And it's like, this guy was in a Cobra bar in a desert, dressed as a sailor, and he's just instantly a Joe.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll you know, we'll still like shoot the shit about that kind of stuff, and like, ooh, he'll send me stupid gifts and stuff. But yeah. So like, Chris has been a good friend for a long time. So when we needed a letterer, you know, he just seemed like a natural fit. And then John pointed out something recently though, that like we're going to bring the team back together. We're going to have our old letterer. And then John, didn't you say that he never actually lettered one of our books?
He lettered one issue of RID that we did together.
Oh, okay.
he lettered some annuals. I was super embarrassing because I was literally working in the same building as him and Sean Lee, who was lettering it. I know Sean lettered it. I remember Sean stopping lettered it, but I thought Chris lettered a bunch of it in the middle. He must have lettered Foundation, right?
We should go check that. I can't be sure.
I can't be sure of anything anymore, but we've both known Chris. Well, I mean, like the funniest thing is like, it's not like I don't talk to Sean Lee all the time, because I do. you know, like it isn't like I forgot somebody as a human. I just got mixed up. Anyway, it was funny. And then Rhonda was, I knew her from, she's colored Ninja Turtles for virtually the entire run at IDW. And then she does like Sam Keith's coloring from when IDW republished the Max through like present day, whatever Sam's working on now, she's usually coloring him. She's awesome. And it took some work to find the right colorist for the book in terms of logistics of it. And, you know, some people had signed on, that other stuff got in the way. It was a comedy of errors for a long time. It was like Spinal Tap for a while. You know, the colors kept blowing up.
Kept killing off colorists. That's what, exactly. That's the scoop today, right?
I felt like it.
John, killer of colorists. Well, I noticed that Rhonda and Andrew, you guys both worked on Atomic Robo as well.
Yeah, it was funny how like she came on and I was like, oh, this is cool. Someone new to work with that I hadn't worked with before. And then I realized that, yeah, she had done like Atomic Robo, which I did a cover for. And then she also colored a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles cover for me years ago, which was also, by the way, John was talking about that earlier, but Turtles was also huge for me. John and I share a lot of cultural touch points as children, but like Turtles was like huge for me. I got into the show and the toys, and then I went back and found the comics and got really into the original run. So that was exciting to work on as well, getting to do a little bit. I didn't do much Turtles, but I've done some covers and stuff.
I love Atomic Robo, so it just kind of stood out to me when I was looking at both of your guys' stuff. For Turtles, I saw the role-playing game at, I don't know, my second middle school, my third, I don't know. At one of the places I moved, somebody brought in the Turtles role-playing game, and I'd never seen the comic. And then within a year, my cousin was telling me about the cartoon. And so I had to find the comic after I had seen Michelangelo being a party dude.
I'm pretty sure I know exactly the role-playing game you're talking about too, like, because I remember having the source book for that and like wishing I had someone to play it with.
Yeah, me too. I had all that stuff too. I don't think I ever played it. I had all the books. I had a chicken character. I had a samurai chicken that I made.
I could find. I had some sketches of characters that I made too. Yeah, I should try to find those if I still have them.
If you guys can pull that stuff out, let's get a game together.
There you go.
Poultry and Steel. I remember that being the title of this drawing I did of the chicken.
That feels very, what was the Darkwing Duck villain? Steelbeak? Feels very Steelbeak.
Oh, yeah.
That's amazing. I found out about the role-playing game either the same year or the year after I sat behind somebody at school who had a Warhammer 40K book. And I went, what is that? And he was like, you wouldn't understand it. Closed the book, put it in his bag, and never spoke to me about it again.
Wow. So you knew Kieran Gillen in high school?
Legitimately, I don't know how this person got it over here in the 80s, because, I mean, it came out in 87 over there. And I only lived there for 6 months, so saying he never spoke to me again is a bit dramatic. However, he did tell me, you wouldn't understand, closed it, because I was looking over his shoulder at, like, what is that? Slid in his book bag and ganged out. And it was in a science class that somebody had the Turtles role-playing game.
I love primary school snobbery. Yeah. Geek snobbery.
I used to go to like a game shop like every week, and I'd buy like, you know, I was really into Mech Warrior and Star Wars role-playing game and stuff.
I still play with Star Wars role-playing game.
The original one?
Yeah, the D6, Westin Games. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
I've got a gang of it just in the other room.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. No, I've taken like storytelling lessons that I passed on to other people from those books. But, your friend or your enemies saying what he said to you about Warhammer was exactly my reaction to Warhammer every time I walked into a game store. Is I don't think I understand this. Like, it looks so cool, but I don't know what that is.
I had a couple touch points with it before now, but now I have a bunch of the painting stuff right there. My little paint station on the floor.
That's awesome. That's cool.
Yeah, sounds like a good hobby. Like that kind of stuff can be really like relaxing and like a nice break from life. You
know? Although I don't know how an artist, a comic book artist at that, has time for painting or anything. Breathing, drinking water. You guys are busy people.
Tell me about it, man. There's so much stuff. I don't know how people get to play like video games and things. I couldn't even imagine having the time in the day, because I'm always trying to meet a deadline. I'm always trying to get something done, and then I'll draw until my eyes are too tired to do it anymore, and then I try to find some time to get some quality time with my wife. And then before you know it, we're going to sleep. And the next day, do it all over again. You know, this is definitely the kind of career you have to love to do in order to do it. You know?
I think that's something that's always compelled me with comic books is that we all have to work with people, but you guys have such a small, tight team with wild deadlines. I'm already sort of the audience you look for, right? I'm already the built-in. I love Star Wars. I love Transformers. I love G.I. Joe. I've not started The Expanse, although one of your friends has written that it feels very Expanse-ish on your Kickstarter.
Weirdly, one of the reasons that comes up is that, look, Expanse is like this sort of hard sci-fi, you're stuck in the solar system kind of thing. Like, I'd sort of done like a Gundam. Like, in my opinion, I was influenced by Gundam, you know, leading us to this.
Love Gundam.
Yeah. And I'm not super familiar with Gundam either, but I actually didn't read or watch any of the Expanse stuff until after we'd started the thing. But I'm more into the books than the TV show. The TV show seems like it's super high quality.
I know they built a role playing game for that too. We are all of an age where all of these things are like, yep, got it.
Yeah.
But with Cigna, the blurb you guys have put out is that hundreds of years after a war, the sun is basically a red dwarf now. So whatever happened during the war has shitted the sun, which means Earth is screwed. The hero, I like the name, by the way, Ketna Vora, has found an old robot, an old mech, an old relic of an ancient past, and awoken it. And then we're going from there.
Yeah.
It feels very like I can see why your friends are comparing it to Star Wars and Expanse, and you guys mentioned Gundam, because it has all of that. It's a very tactile and familiar starting point. I love that.
Yeah, Star Wars is something we talked about a lot. Like, not so much in like we're trying to do it or recreate it or something like that, but in terms of like just certain things that like would always like stick with us from it. Like John always talks about, you know, like when you watch A New Hope, you know, you see Luke, he's this farm boy who goes on this adventure. He's like, all of a sudden he's just like killing tons of people. And it's like, when is the first time that like he kills somebody? And do you ever see him like, you never really see him like react to that. And like, oh my God, I just like killed a dude. Like I've been living on this farm by myself, just dreaming to go down to this Tashi station to see this cute girl and say that I want to go for power converters. But you know what I mean? And all of a sudden he's like blasting away people. We wanted to like address those kind of moments and actually like address our characters as people that are like, when they get thrown into something, that they actually like respond to it and actually it changes them and it affects them. You know, it influences us in those kind of ways, not just in like, we wanted to also have it like a lived in universe. We wanted to have it feel kind of like you could see somebody living in this universe. You could think about why the technology is at the level that it's at this point in time and all that kind of thing. So there was a lot of thought put into that kind of stuff. And then another funny influence is like, sorry if I'm going on too long here. another funny influence that we had was John and I both had read in the 80s this Robotech Defenders book, which is kind of like obscure in my life experience. I haven't seen much of it since then, but it was like this era of Robotech that had these interesting designs, and they're kind of asymmetrical looking mechs, and just a handful of them with their drivers or pilots and stuff. But that was something that kind of stuck with me and when I had to design the mech, because we were designing a new mech for a new universe. It could look like anything, you know what I mean? There's so many out there, and it's almost impossible to create something entirely brand new. But I knew I didn't want it to look like Transformers or Gundam, where it was like a man and with a human face and a helmet on kind of a look. I looked more towards like that old Robotech series or like Battletech or things like that, where it was kind of like chunky and it had like a utilitarian kind of look, where you weren't quite sure what its original purpose was, but you can definitely tell that there are things on it that like, okay, that thing has a purpose. And that's something that I'm hoping we can reveal well as like a mystery as the book goes on, about like what exactly this thing was and what makes it unique and what causes it to become this like character in the book and not just some mech that they found. You know, it's kind of like a unique kind of a living robot kind of a thing. But that will be shown in the story, you know, and I'm pretty happy with how we developed that in the first issue. We kind of just dive right in, and you guys are thrown right, the readers are thrown right into it.
The pages that you guys are showing on the Kickstarter are incredible. Talking about having to create a brand new mech that feels unique, you know, it's something that the rest of us don't think about. That's That is a huge task. And then doing it asymmetrical pays yourself no favors when you're trying to draw each page and each panel.
Yeah.
I had never given thought to how ubiquitous mechs are today to have to build a new one that feels unique. Ugh.
Yeah, we were even like, went back and forth. Should he have a face? Should it not have a face? You know, that kind of thing. And there are elements to it where even the first issue, you'll see where there are, it's not like a transformer, but there are aspects of it where it can assume different forms and modes and stuff. And I think that's an interesting thing to explore, what exactly its capabilities are, just how powerful it is and what it's capable of. I think it's going to be interesting to explore.
One of the common threads that a lot of the stuff that we were describing was that lived in universe, but also that sort of idea that the form sort of follows the function in an interesting way. I mean, that's not always true with like Star Wars. I mean, I think a lot of the stuff in Star Wars is just, that's cool and let's retrofit how it works. But like, I don't know. I think that was a key part in the way Signal looks, was what would you have this thing do? You know, what would the actual things it would do be, and how would you implement those? Yeah, I mean, I think it came out to be, you're more industrial looking than, you know, like slick and sleek and cool. I mean, it looks cool, but it looks cool because it looks like it's built out of something that needs to perform a task. You know, like it's like the same way the same reason my 5-year-old is like super obsessed with trucks and you know, mechanical lifters and stuff, where it's like, that stuff's cool. I don't know. It's got a tactile reality to it that's interesting.
Oh, for sure. Like there's always that appeal when you're a youth, you know, trying to figure out how things work. And it reminds me of one of the most traumatic moments in my life, where as a young kid, I woke up one morning and my younger brother was taking apart my Ultra Magnus toy and saying that he's a mechanic. Ever since, like, my wheels have been missing and stuff from my original G1 Ultra Magnus. But that was pretty traumatic for me.
that was traumatic, and I just heard about it.
I'm a mechanic. I just remember him saying that. I'm like, no, that's not exactly what I'm thinking you are right now. But ever since, I've been trying to replace that hole in my heart by still collecting toys as an adult, you know.
What kind of toys do you guys collect at this point?
I've been mostly into G.I. Joe the last few years. Ironically, a little bit before I started working on the book, I just got really back into it in a big way. I went back and watched the original show. I reread all the original comics. And then I started on its task of like recollecting the original, all the straight arm Joes. That was like my goal, just to recollect those, because I still had some needed parts and things. And I always, ever since I was a kid, I liked fixing Joes, like replacing the O-ring and like putting, you know, getting them put back together as like a solid thing. It felt like restoring antiques or something, like if one had a broken arm, getting another arm and putting it back together and like replacing it. I always kind of liked that. I wanted to rebuild my original, because I had a lot of the original Joes. So I wanted to rebuild that original line, have all the 1982 stuff. And then I pulled down all my old toys out of the attic, and I found that I had a really big Joe collection, kind of bigger than I remembered.
Oh, wow.
So I went about kind of like restoring that and like getting pieces off of eBay that were missing and things like that. And then around the time the classified stuff was coming out, and it was getting good. I didn't like it. I liked it, but I wasn't super excited about the first designs that came out. They were a little too, they weren't quite getting like what made the original characters click for me. So once they started bringing out characters that looked more like that had more of the feel of the original characters, I really got into classified. So I pretty much collect classified, and then every once in a while I'll get some part I'm missing or something from my original Joe collection. And every once in a while I pick up a Transformer, but not as much as I had years ago.
We definitely need to get you out to a Joe Fest then. It's going to be the best place to pick up tons and tons of Joes.
Yeah. By chance, did you ever go to New Jersey Collectors Con? I don't know if they still have it.
It's in Cherry Hill. It still goes on. And I haven't made it up there yet, but I really want to, and I hear great things about it.
Yeah, I used to go to that as an artist, and then I'd also walk around and look at things, pick up a couple things and stuff. But that was like a one-day show that was kind of like a BotCon or something, but it had Transformers and G.I. Joe, but it had more of like a G.I. Joe focus, and a few artists would show up and stuff. And like Aaron Archer from Hasbro would come to it sometimes, and some other artists and stuff like myself, we'd come and kind of set up a table for the day. But it was a pretty good show for like a one-day show. I enjoyed doing it. I should look it up and see about doing it again.
I know Joe Fest is a 3-day, and Larry shows up sometimes. Adam Riches is there. Mark Pennington's been there. So a few artists and writers show up at Joe Fest.
And where is it?
It's in Augusta, Georgia. It is the weekend after Heroes Con or after Father's Day.
Yeah, if I was like invited or something, I'd definitely consider it, or maybe I could even just look into it. But
hell yeah. And John, I know you and I were talking about your book collection because we're both book collectors. But I don't know, do you collect toys as well, or are you just more?
No, I mean, really casually. I've been picking up some of, God, I'm forgetting the name of them, but like the small Star Wars ones that have been coming out lately, where they've got little figures with them.
Yeah, like the Micro Machine kind of stuff.
Yeah, but the ones that have the little guys in them. I don't know, but it's super casual. I've been fiddling around with this Batman toy that I got from the McFarlane ones that come with the comics. I don't know. I've got Thunderbirds, Star Wars stuff, Transformers, G.I. Joe.
Thunderbirds, that's an old pull.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and I asked because I love comics. I collect comics. I love books. I collect books from nonfiction to Star Wars to comics. And I also do a lot of toy collecting. You guys being part of the G.I. Joe lore and brand, I know Josh Blaylock just made his first return to Joe Fest last year, and he also was part of Assembly Required in November. But I pitched Joe Fest because I know you guys are G.I. Joe. You guys have put your handprints, your fingerprints on the property, and you guys are fans. You know, I also bring it up because Cigna, just from what I've seen of Cigna from your Kickstarter, just from the pages you've shown, the line art, I could use those as action figures. And I think, you know, in terms of especially toy collectors, when we're looking at books, a lot of times, you know, you look at a cartoon, you look at a live action, or you look at a comic from the perspective of, can I make a custom of that? Will this ever come out? How would I use this in my play? And obviously, you guys are working on book one. It's hardback. It's 44 pages. So, you know, kind of a double, two issues worth in hardback as your first issue. So we don't have 10 issues of lore yet. But from what you've shown in your first Kickstarter, I think the designs are compelling enough where I could put some of that shit in my playroom.
Well, thanks, man. That means a lot, like, as the one who did the visual designs for it, you know, like... That's definitely the kind of like thing that I love to hear as someone who also sees things like this and is like, oh, I'd like to get a toy of that, or I'd like to have that sitting on my shelf. So to hear someone else say that means a lot. John and I have talked before about like, hey, man, maybe one day we'll have someone at a convention come up cosplaying as our characters or something. Because we've had that before with Transformers, where like we brought back Marissa Fairborn as a character, and I gave her a whole new design, and someone came up to a panel and like asked us a question dressed as that design. I'm like, wow, that's the first time I've ever seen one of my designs show up in real life. So yeah, I don't know. Who knows where this will go or what opportunities we'll have for that kind of, you never know, you know? I mean, never know if someone would be interested in making toys of it or something, but we can hope that it'll be successful enough. But I'd love to see 3D realizations of what we're doing.
And I know that's cart before horse, because we still got to get the Kickstarter in our hands.
Yeah, that's a long way off, but it may be nice if something like
that. For people that don't know, in a lot of the people that run in toy communities, we understand, or we're familiar with the process, the cost of that, because we've had archivists digging that out and talking to all the old 80s Hasbro people and everybody. But for comics, it is really expensive to put out a comic. It doesn't seem like it because it's a few pages, glossy print, but it is expensive as shit to put out a comic. And so to kickstart 44 pages plus back matter, and I'm a huge fan of back matter, which I know you guys have some, and hardback, which also is an over-the-top premium, this isn't a cheap endeavor. So when you guys sat down to do this, from your backgrounds, you could have pitched this to any house, but you come through Kickstarter, and that's a lot of risk that you guys are assuming. But also, it means that right from the jump, we can all jump in and fund and help you from the beginning. We don't have to wait for it to show up in Diamond. We get you guys right up front, hands-on, from the nine. And then we're here to help support you, and you're here to help make cool shit. So I don't know if you want to talk about the Kickstarter process at all, because I know it's a unique thing. I know it's not unique that Kickstarter is now like 15 years old, but... it's still a unique thing in making comics. It's expensive, and it's it's on you.
Not to give us too much credit, we've been like the company Pug W that's putting this out. It's John Nee, and used to be a publisher at Marvel, and he was one of the founders of Wildstorm and Cryptozoic, the game company. He used to be a VP at DC, I think. I think he was a VP, I mean. And who actually just had a novel called The Murder of Mr. Ma come out on Tuesday. And I'm about a third of the way through it, but I am loving it. I am like really enjoying his book. They've been very supportive with us, and they've like, you know, fronted money for Andrew to be able to work on it and everything. It's all coming, you know, it all works out in the end, but hopefully.
It's more of the mixed platform where you're kickstarting it with a publisher.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I missed that, and I apologize.
Oh, no, that's totally cool. Now, one of the things that Kickstarter has done besides, I think Kickstarter's original purpose and a purpose it still fulfills really well is to fund projects that wouldn't be able, you know, you wouldn't be able to get stuff out some other way. Another thing that it has in addition to that, though, is that it's also a unique way to reach audience and like take pre-orders on something. Like there's, you know, in a very real way, Cygnus happening. We did it. We're like the comic issue one isn't in process. Like it's all drawn, colored, lettered. We've got the whole thing. We still need to put together like the back matter and stuff like that. I don't mean like there's nothing to do, but it's going to be out there somehow. But it's such a weird time, or I mean, not, I don't know. Weird's fine. But a unique time for reaching people because the audience is so bifurcated and so in so many different places, you know, that like even 15 years ago before Kickstarter or, you know, 20 years ago, certainly when we were growing up, if you liked comics, you had to go to a comic book store and get comics because there wasn't another place to get them. You know, you could get them at 7-Eleven, or you could go to B. Dalton and they would have three comics, you know, they'd have ElfQuest and Dark Knight.
Yes, they would.
well, yeah, ElfQuest for sure. Yeah.
But, you know, now comics in a big way are a lot more mainstream in that there isn't like a stigma attached to them the way there was, I think, when we were younger. Even if it wasn't one that we cared about, like it was still something that people would look at comics and it would be different than reading a regular book. And I don't think that exists anymore. Certainly doesn't exist with kids today. You know, like kids growing up, like my kids, like there's no difference between reading Dog Man and reading, you know, middle grade prose novel. Like it's the same thing. It fulfills the same role in a way that didn't before. But that means that the audience is like all over the place. So, you know, it used to be like if you were people reading Transformers would be the ones that would either casually run into it at 7-Eleven or whatever. But at a certain point, it was if you were reading Transformers, you were a comic book fan that was going to a comic book store and you also happened to like Transformers. And I think we lived through a lot of that change where a lot of the people reading Transformers when we were doing it, they don't have anything against comics, but they don't particularly care about the medium. They like Transformers, and there's Transformers in comics. I'm going to get it. Sure. I like Transformers. If there's another comic that's a subject they like, they'll pick that up too. That's, you know, not a big deal. But that means there isn't like a centralized location you can go to find people looking for new comics, you know? So I think that's the thing that's useful with Kickstarter is just having it out there. It's something you can immediately find out about, click on it, and you're going to get it in a couple months or whatever the printing time winds up being. And you don't need to go to a store. You don't need to go to a specialty shop. Not that I don't love, I mean, I go to the store every week. I love it. I think everybody should. I have a great time, but you don't have to, you know, like there's other ways to enjoy comics. I think part of it's a long-winded way of getting to, part of it is reacting to just the shift of the way people interact with properties now or interact with stories and interact with items that they have. I don't know. Maybe this is rambly and doesn't make sense, but.
No, it's great. We're all coming from this from our own perspectives and what we love and how we love to consume. I sold a DVD collection when I got Netflix. A lot of us prefer our comics in trade format, but the industry still sort of punishes trade waiting. And then I am never going to be your digital audience. I'm never going to read your comic book on my phone or my iPad. But I have friends that are just as much into comics that they won't buy paper anymore. So you're right. It's a different world. We're all scattered. We can sort of cherry pick how we consume in today's markets. So when I was looking at Kickstarter, like I immediately am coming at it from my own perspective and my own touch and feel on Kickstarter in doing things without the mixed platform of having a publisher while Kickstartering. That's the benefit of you guys being professionals and being in this market, and you have this way of doing this, where, as you said, this exists, this is real, this is now your pre-order function. And that's, I very much treat Kickstarter as a pre-order mechanism, which is why I'm well over 200 Kickstarters in. Don't judge my wallet. It hurts. So I love that you guys have this platform where you're using your expertise and your professional side of things to have a publisher, but it's not Marvel where you're kind of drowning in the sea of Avengers, or it's not DC where you're drowning in the sea of Batman, and you can still kickstart because it is your personal project. You are asking for that fan readership to help boost you guys, but you also have the partnership with a publisher. I think it's great, and I'm glad you corrected me. So thank you, and I'm sorry I got it wrong.
No, it really was. At one point, we were at like a meeting with Johnny, me, other people from PugW, and John was like, "What's the thing you really want to do?" I'm like, "Well, I really want to do Cigna, this book with Andrew." We might not have even had Cigna as the title yet, but we were putting our pitch together right then. And they've been super supportive the whole time, and getting to be the first original comic coming out. And, you know, we're doing like the Conan artist book and Marvel 3D comics and stuff. And it's exciting, and but it's still our own thing. You know what I mean? Like there's no corporate oversight. There's no, hopefully other stuff comes out of this. We'd love to have the toys. I think it'd be cool to have other stuff come out, but the comic's the main thing for us, or for me. The toys would probably be the next coolest one to have, just because of Andrew's design.
Because it's hardback, I get to put it right on my bookshelf. You know, for me is very much, I prefer that over the bag and board. Although, don't get me wrong, I still have my long boxes. I'm excited for what you guys are doing, because it looks beautiful. And just understanding a bit of where you guys come from and who you guys are. Where did the name Cigna come from? Is that something that we learn in the book, or is that...
Don't learn it in issue one, but we will find out what Cigna means.
It's a cool logo. I really like the design of the robot. The name Ketna Avora has a real nice ring to it. I don't know which one of you guys is good with naming things, but that the name sounds pleasant to say.
Yeah, I think that one was Andrew.
I don't know if I want to give away my secret for how I come up with names sometimes, but like I do have like a method for like when we're looking for a name of like how to come up with something unique and I did want it to sound like, you know, like that's always a hard thing with sci-fi stuff. If it sounds too prosaic, too normal, too everyday, like one of our names, it just doesn't sound right for a sci-fi universe, even if it's like related to Earth. Even if it makes total sense to be like John Smith or something, like it just sounds weird, you know. You wanted to have that slightly esoteric kind of quality to it, and it sounds kind of like it could have come from like Central Europe or something, or slightly Slavic or something like that. But like it definitely has its roots in like, you know, the real world. But it's not a name that we could find that anybody really has or uses. I mean, it might exist somewhere and probably does, but like Ketna or something. But and then the name too, we went through so many different iterations of this book, and so many times we thought, oh, we have the name, it's perfect. And then we'd realize that like, oh, that's a main character in like Harry Potter, or that's like, that's there's some new video game coming out that has the name of this thing that we were going to call it, or, you know, so we went through a lot of iterations of this. And it was kind of funny, speaking of iterations, was we had even done a pitch years ago where we did a whole 5-page pitch, art and everything. We went back to it again and changed it after that. We were just kind of getting back into it and starting to think about it a lot again, because we both got busy with different projects, and I was doing Joe and did some Star Wars, and John had done that, and then he left IDW, and we were kind of going through life changes and things. So we'd fall out of the habit of working on this, and then we got back into it, and we really got back into it again. We really decided to focus on it. And I remember I went to do a show in South Africa. I did South Africa Comic Con, and I was at my like lodging, you know, I was just waking up the first morning, and like adjusting to the time change and everything. And John started texting me. He's like, hey, you know, I think this company, I think we want to publish this book. And like you said, I don't remember if it was called Cigna at that point or not. But so I've always wanted to do my own creator own book with John, you know. So like that was a big moment for me, just being like, wow, okay, somebody actually believes enough in what we're doing to want to publish it. That meant a lot to me. So I still remember that moment and that little text conversation. So yeah, it's been a long, interesting process in how this has come about.
Well, if the first grumblings of this was 2011 and we're here in 2024, that is again back to how the level of effort it takes to make comics. Most of us as kids are like, comics, it's a 5-minute thing. Look, I drew one at lunch at the table. But as adults, it's really mind-boggling how long it can take to put a good comic together. And I noticed when I was looking at your guys' Kickstarter, like some of your old friends are doing alternate covers for you guys, like Tom Scioli for, you know, Transformers and G.I. Joe Fanatics. But I also noticed you guys are doing something that I've seen before. Some of your Kickstarter goals, like you have a couple slots for writers who want to have script reviews. You know, I don't know what the Robot in Disguise original pitch or experience is, but that's another thing where you guys have some interesting things for people who might want to have a nice behind the scenes look at, you know, making comics.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of, some of that, the Transformers stuff came out of like, what if we could do something really special and have some of the original, like original sketches that Andrew did. Like there isn't really an original script. So it's going to be like sort of a hand annotated, you know, printout. But the, you know, obviously the printout's going to be from this year, not the past, because I didn't print it out then. you know, stuff for like the, you know, I don't know if you're super into that and really want a piece of Transformers history or a piece of our history, that's there. But it kind of came up, I think it was Mason that suggested, like, you know, I mean, you've edited at Marvel and IDW and all this stuff. Like, what if you had something that was like, you know, your expertise? It was kind of trying to find like, hey, Andrew can do a sketch and it can look cool. I could do a sketch, but I don't think it would look that cool. So is there something I can do? You know, so it's not just all on Andrew. So we'll see if we have any takers. We definitely had takers on getting drawn into Cigna.
Which is also a cool thing that this level of comics allows you guys to do, is put your friends in it. You couldn't exactly do that with the Avengers. You couldn't say, Jay, I'm putting you in the Avengers.
No, but you can draw in Samuel L. Jackson and have that go somewhere.
Yeah, depends who your friends are.
No, yeah, I had a friend last night texting me like 3 a.m. He's like, hey, I want to be in your book. I was like, well, have you seen the Kickstarter? So, and then 5 minutes later, he's like, done. I'm pledged. So
perfect. I did that for a friend. He was doing his version of Beowulf. So he did Beowulf as a comic, and it was his kind of take on it. And that was one of his goals as well. It was kind of a fun little thing to say, your face is in a comic. So I think it's a really neat thing for people that are either really excited about the project or are really interested in seeing that kind of thing come to fruition. I think it's fun. And the fact that your friend calls you at 3 a.m, you go, well, we have a pathway. That's not a thing. That's not a thing I can say no to. That's awesome. I also love, you know, script reviews or art reviews, things like that, because there's so many of us that we're not professional, but we are creative. And you can learn a lot on YouTube and you can learn a lot from friends, but having a true professional look at your stuff and go, listen, I think with, you know, some hard work and these changes, you're 6 months out from getting a small gig, or, you know, hey, listen, maybe at where you're at right now, you should be taking classes.
It's funny too, because I've found, and I mean, I've done a lot of portfolio reviews in my time and, you know, a fair number of script reviews. There's basic advice that exists out there, but that you can't just cut and paste it for everybody, because there are definitely people where I would give opposite advice to sometimes, you know what I mean? Where like, here's where you are. Here's the thing you should probably, you know, here's the thing I would suggest. Or, I mean, the key thing I would always ask this when I'm doing portfolio reviews is, like, what do you want? Like, what do you want to come out of this with? Because if you want to get a job drawing, you know, Batman or the Avengers, that's one path. But if you want to be out doing your own comics and, you know, publishing them yourself, that's a different path, and maybe the things you should concentrate are different. And, you know, being able to do that kind of one-on-one is really different than just kind of being blanket, you know, follow the 180 degree rule and do better anatomy. And, you know,
and it's also kind of a valuable thing to offer. I mean, someone like John, who's had so much experience editing at Marvel and IDW and everything, and even someone like myself, I do a lot of conventions, and I'll be there in Artist Alley, and I'll have so many young people come up to me, hey, can you give me a portfolio review? And I have to turn people down a lot of the times because I'm so busy, like, you know, selling prints, doing commissions, and engaging with people all day long. It's hard to, like, sometimes they have a tendency to come up at the wrong time and ask. And I don't mean that in like a disparaging way at all. It just always seems to be like at the wrong time where I'm like, I've got a million things going on. So being able to offer like a dedicated time to look and give real feedback and advice, and like John said, like custom advice to their particular talents and what they need to improve on and work on and everything, it can be a valuable thing to offer in something like this.
No, I laughed because I was in nightclubs for over two decades. And one of the things that I saw over and over again would be people that were dancers and friends with the DJs would come, and they would never speak to the DJ until that one moment where the DJ has the headphones on and they're getting ready to mix.
Yeah.
And then it's like, hey, Andrew, could you, and he's like, come on, man.
Right.
30 seconds before I touch the thing or 30 seconds after, but not during, please. So when you said that people come up at the wrong time, I think that's clearly nothing malicious. It's simply that, you know, these are fans that don't necessarily know what your day looks like or what your table looks like, and they're excited to see you. But, you know, but that's where pre-commissions come from, and sketchbooks, and reaching out to artists before the show to say, hey, at the show, if I bring my portfolio, do you have time? When would you have time? Can we set something up? Is always just a great tweak for any of us that are coming to see any of you guys, and whether that's for writers or for artists.
And there's so much to it too, because you also have to like learn to be professional. You know, a lot of people come into this and they don't quite make it because they don't know how to like work with people, how to communicate with editors, how to manage your taxes and your income and all that kind of stuff. It's like, I wasn't there, but I've heard so many stories through friends that worked at like Wildstorm and things. And back in the 90s heyday, where people would like get hired and make tons of money on like a book when they're a hotshot artist. And then they forget to save money for their taxes. And like, they just have to go get a full-time job because like, they can't do this anymore. You know, it's like, but yeah, it's like, there's so much to it besides just learning to draw with perspective and learning to draw sequentials as well. So it's like, even if you can do it artistically, can you do it, you know, working all day long until you go to bed and then waking up the next morning to do it all over again? And, you know, it's like, it's a lot to this job, and it's a lot to communicate to people who want to do it, what it entails.
And sometimes you got to draw 8 billion robots.
Yes, literally. One thing I do want to say real quick, I know that John has to go soon, but I did want to point out too, that like one thing about the Kickstarter, and I'm not that familiar with the back end of everything. John's working in the company. I'm kind of on the outside, but how I see it is like John said, we have the book ready. So people don't have to worry about committing to it and then wondering if we're ever going to follow through, because we have this book, but not only this, we have a few arcs of stories that we're excited to tell if we get the chance. And the way I look at it, when people ask me about why we're kickstarting it, is like, you know, if we can get the capital here and get the engagement, get like pre-orders set up and everything, the more support we can get initially and get people interested and engaged and committed to it, the more we're going to have the opportunity to finish telling the story we want to tell.
Yeah.
And then more, you know, we have tons of ideas of how to continue this. Yeah. And we're really excited to do it. So if people want to see that, this is the best way to help make sure that can happen.
I always say that it's easier to be seen on Kickstarter than on page 467 of the Diamond Catalog.
Yeah. Yeah.
No doubt.
A little bit of an aside here, but it is funny when you have a Kickstarter going, I'm getting messages like as we talk, and people are like, you're at 93%, like all excited. I'm like, it's just kind of funny, like how other people are keeping an eye out for us and stuff.
That is the beauty of Kickstarter, is you see your community. I mean, at this point, you're kind of a street magician, you know, you're doing it in front of everyone. And so your community gets to celebrate every percentage with you. And I think that's kind of the beauty of Kickstarter.
Yeah, that's for sure. It's right out in front of everybody. Everybody can see what we're doing and how well we're doing and stuff. So that's true.
When it comes to finding you guys online, other than the Kickstarter, which the Kickstarter is easily findable by just doing Cigna, S-I-G-N-A. What is your favorite way for people that want to follow you guys online and support what you guys do outside of the Kickstarter?
I usually use, if it's available, and I usually try to get it before anybody else does, is Glove Studios. So years ago, before I did all this stuff, I started my own freelance kind of company, or whatever, just to do design and stuff for people. So if you go to Twitter or Instagram or anything like that, I'm on Threads and Blue Sky, and I'm not on TikTok, but I am on. So it's usually, if you can find me at Glove Studios on ArtStation, DeviantArt. Some things I keep up with more than others. I tend to get the most engagement and the most activity on Twitter. So that's probably where I'm the most active, but I try to post all my commissions and as much as I can update things on Instagram as well. So that's where people can usually find me. Or if you just search my name and Transformers or my name and different things I worked on, you'll find me.
I'm on Twitter. I'm the John Barber. I'm on Blue Sky. I'm just John Barber at Blue Sky. So yeah, follow me there. I have really been infrequent posting because the ongoing trash fire that is the world. But yes. I've been posting there a lot the last couple of days. So we'll see if that sticks this time.
John also has kids and a full-time job. And someone like me, I'm sitting here working by myself all day. So sometimes it's nice just to have that little break and engage for a little bit, you know?
I try and follow everybody on Blue Sky, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, if I have to. So the John Barber on Twitter, John Barber on Blue Sky, Glove Studios everywhere. And honestly, guys, I really appreciate you guys doing this.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
From one, 80s kid to the next, as we delve into the fact that we all play with the same shit, if we had lived in the same neighborhood, maybe John would be saying our names, Andrew, instead of other people's.
I can get a John Barber name drop.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I already do because we're working together. But
I usually just call you the artist.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. That's what Larry does. Every time I worked on G.I. Joe, no matter who worked on the book, what issue it was, he just referred to us as the artist. You know? I'm like, I'm 5 issues in. You don't know who I am. It's like, he's like, have the artist do this. Or does the artist know I want this? Or, stuff like that.
I do. I appreciate you guys. And I'm excited for Cigna. I wish it the best and well, and I'll be reading it when it comes out. But thank you guys for coming on.
Yeah, man. It's been great.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for having us. It's been great.
Let's end it here. Thanks again for spending time with us discussing toys and other geeky things. Our logo was made by Rhino. The music we use was created by Self Help. You can find Joel on Instagram at Order of Battle Pod. Jason is on Twitter at Order of Battle PD. Our email is orderofbattlepod@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you, and thank you for your likes, comments, outreaches, and just being here with us.
This has been the Order of Battle.